and ambitious efforts should have transgressed the standard of moderation. A Turkish cannon, more enormous than that of Mohammed, still guards the entrance of the Dardanelles, and if the use be inconvenient, it has been found on a late trial that the effect was far from contemptible. A stone bullet of 1,100 pounds weight was once discharged with 330 pounds of powder. At the distance of 600 yards, it shivered into 3 rocky fragments, traversed the strait, and, leaving the waters in a foam, again rose and bounded against the opposite hill. While Mohammed threatened the capital of the East, the Greek emperor implored with fervent prayers the assistance of earth and heaven. But the invisible powers were deaf to his supplications, and Christendom beheld with indifference the fall of Constantinople, while she derived at least some promise of supply from the jealous and temporal policy of the Sultan of Egypt. Some states were too weak, and others too remote. By some the danger was considered as imaginary, by others as inevitable. The Western princes were involved in their endless and domestic quarrels. Then the Roman pontiff was exasperated by the falsehood or obstinacy of the Greeks. Instead of employing in their favor the arms and treasures of Italy, Nicholas V had foretold their approaching ruin, and his honor was engaged in the accomplishment of his prophecy. Perhaps he was softened by the last extremity of their distress, but his compassion was tardy, his efforts were faint and unavailing, and Constantinople had fallen before the squadrons of Genoa and Venice could sail from their harbors. Even the princes of the Morea and of the Greek islands affected a cold neutrality. The Genoese colony of Galata negotiated a private treaty, and the Sultan indulged them in the delusive hope that by his clemency they might survive the ruin of the empire. A plebeian crowd and some Byzantine nobles basely withdrew from the danger of their country, and the avarice of the rich denied the emperor and reserved for the Turks the secret treasures which might have raised in their defense whole armies of mercenaries. The indigent and solitary prince prepared, however, to sustain his formidable adversary. But if his courage were equal to the peril, his strength was inadequate to the contest. In the beginning of the spring, the Turkish vanguard swept the towns and villages as far as the gates of Constantinople. Submission was spared and protected. Whatever presumed to resist was exterminated with fire and sword. The Greek places on the Black Sea, Mesembria, Akelum, and Bizon, surrendered on the first summons. Celebria alone deserved the honors of a siege or blockade, and the bold inhabitants, while they were invested by land, launched their boats, pillaged the opposite coast of Cyzicus, and sold their captives in the public market. But on the approach of Mohammed himself all was silent and prostrate. He first halted at the distance of 5 miles, and from thence, advancing in battle array, planted before the gates of St. Romanus the imperial standard, and on the 6th day of April formed the memorable siege of Constantinople. The troops of Asia and Europe extended on the right and left from the Propontis to the harbor. The Janissaries in the front were stationed before the Sultan's tent. The Ottoman line was covered by deep entrenchment, and a subordinate army enclosed the suburb of Galata and watched the doubtful faith of the Genoese. The inquisitive Philelphus, who resided in Greece about 30 years before the siege, is confident that all the Turkish forces of any name or value could not exceed the number of 60,000 horse and 20,000 foot, and he upbraids the pusillanimity of the nations who had tamely yielded to a handful of barbarians. Such indeed might be the regular establishment of the Capiculi, the troops of the port who marched with the prince and were paid from his royal treasury. But the bashaws in their respective governments maintained or levied a provincial militia. Many lands were held by military tenure, Many volunteers were attracted by the hope of spoil, and the sound of the holy trumpet invited a swarm of hungry and fearless fanatics, who might contribute at least to multiply the terrors, and in a first attack to blunt the swords of the Christians. The whole mass of the Turkish powers is magnified by Dukas, Kalkondyles, and Leonard of Chios, to the amount of 300,000 or 400,000 men. But Pranza was a less remote and more accurate judge, and his precise definition of 258,000 does not exceed the measure of experience and probability. The navy of the besiegers was less formidable. The Propontis was overspread with 320 sail, but of these no more than 18 could be rated as galleys of war, and the far greater part must be degraded to the condition of storeships and transports, which poured into the camp fresh supplies of men, ammunition, and provisions. In her last decay, Constantinople was still peopled with more than 100,000 inhabitants, but these numbers are found in the accounts not of war but of captivity, and they mostly consisted of mechanics, of priests, of women, and of men devoid of that spirit which even women have sometimes exerted for the common safety. I can suppose, I could almost excuse, the reluctance of subjects to serve on a distant frontier at the will of a tyrant, but the man who dares not expose his life in the defense of his children and his property has lost in society the first and most active energies of nature. By the emperor's command, a particular inquiry had been made through the streets and houses how many of the citizens, or even of the monks, were able and willing to bear arms for their country. The lists were entrusted to Pranza, and, after a diligent addition, informed his master, with grief and surprise, that the national defense was reduced to 4,970 Romans. Between Constantine and his faithful minister, this comfortless secret was preserved, and a sufficient proportion of shields, crossbows, and muskets were distributed from the arsenal to the city bands. They derived some accession from a body of 2,000 strangers under the command of John Giustiniani, a noble Genoese. A liberal donative was advanced to these auxiliaries, and a princely recompense, the Isle of Lemnos, was promised to the valor and victory of their chief. A strong chain was drawn across the mouth of the harbor. It was supported by some Greek and Italian vessels of war and merchandise, and the ships of every Christian nation that successively arrived from Candia and the Black Sea were detained for the public service. Against the powers of the Ottoman Empire, a city of the extent of 13, perhaps of 16 miles, was defended by a scanty garrison of 7,000 or 8,000 soldiers. Europe and Asia were open to the besiegers, but the strength and provisions of the Greeks must sustain a daily decrease. Nor could they indulge the expectation of any foreign succor or supply. The primitive Romans would have drawn their swords in the resolution of death or conquest. The primitive Christians might have embraced each other and awaited in patience and charity the stroke of martyrdom. But the Greeks of Constantinople were animated only by the spirit of religion, and that spirit was productive only of animosity and discord. Before his death, the emperor, John Palaeologus, had renounced the unpopular measure of a union with the Latins, nor was the idea revived till the distress of his brother Constantine imposed a last trial of flattery and dissimulation. With the demand of temporal aid, his ambassadors were instructed to mingle the assurance of spiritual obedience. His neglect of the church was excused by the urgent cares of the state, and his orthodox wishes solicited the presence of a Roman legate. The Vatican had been too often deluded, yet the signs of repentance could not decently be overlooked. A legate was more easily granted than an army, and about 6 months before the final destruction, the Cardinal Isidore of Russia appeared in that character with a retinue of priests and soldiers. The Emperor saluted him as a friend and father, respectfully listened to his public and private sermons, and with the most obsequious of the clergy and laymen, subscribed the Act of Union, as it had been ratified in the Council of Florence. On the 12th of December, the two nations and the Church of Santa Sophia joined in the communion of sacrifice and prayer, and the names of the two pontiffs were solemnly commemorated, the names of Nicholas the Fifth, the Vicar of Christ, and of the Patriarch Gregory, who had been driven into exile by a rebellious people. But the dress and language of the Latin priest who officiated at the altar were an object of scandal, and it was observed with horror that he consecrated a cake or wafer of unleavened bread and poured cold water into the cup of the sacrament. A national historian acknowledges, with a blush, that none of his countrymen, not the emperor himself, were sincere in this occasional conformity. Their hasty and unconditional submission was palliated by promise of future revisal. But the best or the worst of their excuses was the confession of their own perjury. When they were pressed by the reproaches of their honest brethren, "Have patience," they whispered, "have patience till God shall have delivered the city from the great dragon who seeks to devour us. You shall then perceive whether we are truly reconciled with the Azimites." But patience is not the attribute of zeal, nor can the arts of a court be adapted to the freedom and violence of popular enthusiasm. From the dome of Santa Sophia, the inhabitants of either sex and of every degree rushed in crowds to the cell of the monk Gennadius to consult the oracle of the church. The holy man was invisible, entranced, as it should seem, in deep meditation or divine rapture, but he had exposed on the door of his cell a speaking tablet, and they successively withdrew after reading those tremendous words, "O miserable Romans, why will ye abandon the truth? And why, instead of confiding in God, will ye put your trust in the Italians? In losing your faith you will lose your city. Have mercy on me, O Lord. I protest in thy presence that I am innocent of the crime. O miserable Romans, consider, pause, and repent. At the same moment that you renounce the religion of your fathers, by embracing impiety, you submit to a foreign servitude." According to the advice of Gennadius, the religious virgins, as pure as angels and as proud as demons, rejected the act of union and abjured all communion with the present and future associates of the Latins. And their example was applauded and imitated by the greatest part of the clergy and people. From the monastery, the devout Greeks dispersed themselves in the taverns, drank confusion to the slaves of the Pope, emptied the glasses in honor of the image of the Holy Virgin, and besought her to defend against Mohammed the city which she had formerly saved from Khosroes and the Chagan. In the double intoxication of zeal and wine, they valiantly exclaimed, "What occasion have we for succor, or union, or Latins? Far from us be the worship of the Azimites." During the winter that preceded the Turkish conquest, the nation was distracted by this epidemical frenzy, and the season of Lent, the approach of Easter, instead of breathing charity and love, served only to fortify the obstinacy and influence of the zealots. The confessors scrutinized and alarmed the conscience of their votaries, and a rigorous penance was imposed on those who had received the communion from a priest who had given an express or tacit consent to the union. His service at the altar propagated the infection to the mute and simple spectators of the ceremony, They forfeited, by the impure spectacle, the virtue of the sacerdotal character. Nor was it lawful, even in danger of sudden death, to invoke the assistance of their prayers or absolution. No sooner had the church of Santa Sophia been polluted by the Latin sacrifice than it was deserted as a Jewish synagogue or a heathen temple by the clergy and people. And a vast and gloomy silence prevailed in that venerable dome, which had so often smoked with a cloud of incense, blazed with innumerable lights, and resounded with the voice of prayer and thanksgiving. The Latins were the most odious of heretics and infidels, and the first minister of the empire, the great duke, was heard to declare that he had rather behold in Constantinople the turban of Mohammed than the pope's tiara or a cardinal's hat. A sentiment so unworthy of Christians and patriots was familiar and fatal to the Greeks. The emperor was deprived of the affection and support of his subjects, and their native cowardice was sanctified by resignation to the divine decree, or the visionary hope of a miraculous deliverance. Of the triangle which composes the figure of Constantinople, the two sides along the sea were made inaccessible to an enemy, the Propontis by nature and the harbour by art. Between the two waters, the basis of the triangle, the land side was protected by a double wall and a deep ditch of the depth of 100 feet. Against this line of fortification, which Franza, an eyewitness, prolongs to the measure of 6 miles, the Ottomans directed their principal attack, and the emperor, after distributing the service and command of the most perilous stations, undertook the defense of the external wall. In the first days of the siege, the Greek soldiers descended into the ditch, or sallied into the field. But they soon discovered that in the proportion of their numbers, one Christian was of more value than 20 Turks. And after these bold preludes, they were prudently content to maintain the rampart with their missile weapons. Nor should this prudence be accused of pusillanimity. The nation was indeed pusillanimous and base. But the last Constantine deserves the name of a hero. His noble band of volunteers was inspired with Roman virtue, and the foreign auxiliaries supported the honor of the Western chivalry. The incessant volleys of lances and arrows were accompanied with the smoke, the sound, and the fire of their musketry and cannon. Their small arms discharged at the same time either 5 or even 10 balls of lead of the size of a walnut, and according to the closeness of the ranks and the force of the powder, several breastplates and bodies were transpierced by the same shot. But the Turkish approaches were soon sunk in trenches, or covered with ruins. Each day added to the science of the Christians, but their inadequate stock of gunpowder was wasted in the operations of each day. Their ordnance was not powerful, either in size or number, and if they possessed some heavy cannon, they feared to plant them on the walls, lest the aged structure should be shaken and overthrown by the explosion. The same destructive secret had been revealed to the Muslims, by whom it was employed with the superior energy of zeal, riches, and despotism. The great cannon of Muhammad has been separately noticed, an important and visible object in the history of the times. But that enormous engine was flanked by 2 fellows almost of equal magnitude. The long order of the Turkish artillery was pointed against the walls. 14 batteries thundered at once on the most accessible places. And of one of these it is ambiguously expressed that it was mounted with 130 guns, or that it discharged 130 bullets. Yet in the power and activity of the Sultan, we may discern the infancy of the new science. Under a master who counted the moments, the great cannon could be loaded and fired no more than 7 times in one day. The heated metal unfortunately burst. Several workmen were destroyed, and the skill of an artist was admired who bethought himself of preventing the danger and the accident by pouring oil after each explosion into the mouth of the cannon. The first random shots were productive of more sound than effect, and it was by the advice of a Christian that the engineers were taught to level their aim against the two opposite sides of the salient angles of a bastion. However imperfect, the weight and repetition of the fire made some impression on the walls, and the Turks, pushing their approaches to the edge of the ditch, attempted to fill the enormous chasm and to build a road to the assault. Innumerable fascines and hogsheads and trunks of trees were heaped on each other, and such was the impetuosity of the throng that the foremost and the weakest were pushed headlong down the precipice and instantly buried under the accumulated mass. To fill the ditch was the toil of the besiegers. To clear away the rubbish was the safety of the besieged. And after a long and bloody conflict, the web that had been woven in the day was still unravelled in the night. The next resource of Mohammed was the practice of mines. But the soil was rocky. In every attempt he was stopped and undermined by the Christian engineers. Nor had the art been yet invented of replenishing those subterraneous passages with gunpowder and blowing whole towers and cities into the air. A circumstance that distinguishes the siege of Constantinople is the reunion of the ancient and modern artillery. The cannon were intermingled with the mechanical engines for casting stones and darts. The bullet and the battering ram were directed against the same walls, nor had the discovery of gunpowder superseded the use of the liquid and unextinguishable fire. A wooden turret of the largest size was advanced on rollers. This portable magazine of ammunition and fascines was protected by a threefold covering of bull's hides. Incessant volleys were securely discharged from the loopholes. In the front, three doors were contrived for the alternate sally and retreat of the soldiers and workmen. They ascended by staircase to the upper platform, and as high as the level of that platform, a scaling ladder could be raised by pulleys to form a bridge and grapple with the adverse rampart. By these various arts of annoyance, some as new as they were pernicious to the Greeks, the tower of St. Romanus was at length overturned. After a severe struggle, the Turks were repulsed from the breach and interrupted by darkness. But they trusted that with the return of light they should renew the attack with fresh vigor and decisive success. Of this pause of action, this interval of hope, each moment was improved by the activity of the Emperor and Giustiniani, who passed the night on the spot and urged the labors which involved the safety of the church and city. At the dawn of day, the impatient Sultan perceived, with astonishment and grief, that his wooden turret had been reduced to ashes. The ditch was cleared and restored, and the tower of St. Romanus was again strong and entire. He deplored the failure of his design, and uttered a profane exclamation that the word of the 37,000 prophets should not have compelled him to believe that such a work in so short a time could have been accomplished by the infidels. The generosity of the Christian princes was cold and tardy. But in the first apprehension of a siege, Constantine had negotiated, in the isles of the archipelago, the Morea, and Sicily, the most indispensable supplies. As early as the beginning of April, five great ships, equipped for merchandise and war, would have sailed from the harbour of Chios, had not the wind blown obstinately from the north. One of these ships bore the imperial flag. The remaining four belonged to the Genoese, and they were laden with wheat and barley, with wine, oil, and vegetables, and above all with soldiers and mariners for the service of the capital. After a tedious delay, a gentle breeze, and on the second day a strong gale from the south, carried them through the Hellespont and the Propontis. But the city was already invested by sea and land, and the Turkish fleet at the entrance of the Bosphorus was stretched from shore to shore in the form of a crescent to intercept or at least to repel these bold auxiliaries. The reader who has present to his mind the geographical picture of Constantinople will conceive and admire the greatness of the spectacle. The five Christian ships continued to advance with joyful shouts and a full press both of sails and oars against a hostile fleet of 300 vessels. And the rampart, the camp, the coasts of Europe and Asia were lined with innumerable spectators who anxiously awaited the event of this momentous succor. At the first view, that event could not appear doubtful. The superiority of the Muslims was beyond all measure or account, and in a calm, their numbers and valor must inevitably have prevailed. But their hasty and imperfect navy had been created not by the genius of the people, but by the will of the Sultan. In the height of their prosperity, the Turks have acknowledged that if God had given them the earth, he had left the sea to the infidels, and a series of defeats, a rapid progress of decay, has established the truth of their modest confession. Except 18 galleys of some force, the rest of their fleet consisted of open boats, rudely constructed and awkwardly managed, crowded with troops and destitute of cannon. And since courage arises in a great measure from the consciousness of strength, the bravest of the Janissaries might tremble on a new element. In the Christian squadron, five stout and lofty ships were guided by skillful pilots, and manned with the veterans of Italy and Greece, long practiced in the arts and perils of the sea. Their weight was directed to sink or scatter the weak obstacles that impeded their passage. Their artillery swept the waters. Their liquid fire was poured on the heads of the adversaries, who, with the design of boarding, presumed to approach them. And the winds and waves are always on the side of the ablest navigators. In this conflict, the imperial vessel, which had been almost overpowered, was rescued by the Genoese. But the Turks, in a distant and closer attack, were twice repulsed with considerable loss. Mohammed himself sat on horseback on the beach to encourage their valor by his voice and presence, by the promise of reward, and by fear more potent than the fear of the enemy. The passions of his soul, and even the gestures of his body, seemed to imitate the actions of the combatants. And as if he had been the lord of nature, he spurred his horse with a fearless and impotent effort into the sea. His loud reproaches and the clamors of the camp urged the Ottomans to a third attack, more fatal and bloody than the two former. And I must repeat, though I cannot credit the evidence of Franza, who affirms from their own mouth that they lost above 12,000 men in the slaughter of the day. They fled in disorder to the shores of Europe and Asia, while the Christian squadron, triumphant and unhurt, steered along the Bosphorus and securely anchored within the chain of the harbor. In the confidence of victory, they boasted that the whole Turkish power must have yielded to their arms. But the admiral, or Captain Bashaw, found some consolation for a painful wound in his eye by representing that accident as the cause of his defeat. Balti Ogli was a renegade of the race of the Bulgarian princes. His military character was tainted by the unpopular vice of avarice, and under the despotism of the prince or people, misfortune is a sufficient evidence of guilt. His rank and services were annihilated by the displeasure of Mohammed. In the royal presence, the captain Bashaw was extended on the ground by four slaves and received 100 strokes with a golden rod. His death had been pronounced, and he adored the clemency of the Sultan, who was satisfied with the milder punishment of confiscation and exile. The introduction of this supply revived the hopes of the Greeks and accused the supineness of their Western allies. Amidst the deserts of Anatolia and the rocks of Palestine, the millions of the Crusades had buried themselves in a voluntary and inevitable grave. But the situation of the imperial city was strong against her enemies and accessible to her friends. and a rational and moderate armament of the marine states might have saved the relics of the Roman name and maintained a Christian fortress in the heart of the Ottoman Empire. Yet this was the sole and feeble attempt for the deliverance of Constantinople. The more distant powers were insensible of its danger, and the ambassador of Hungary, or at least of Hunyadi's, resided in the Turkish camp to remove the fears and to direct the operations of the Sultan. It was difficult for the Greeks to penetrate the secret of the Divan. Yet the Greeks are persuaded that a resistance so obstinate and surprising had fatigued the perseverance of Muhammad. He began to meditate a retreat, and the siege would have been speedily raised if the ambition and jealousy of the second vizier had not opposed the perfidious advice of Khalil Basho, who still maintained a secret correspondence with the Byzantine court. The reduction of the city appeared to be hopeless unless a double attack could be made from the harbour as well as from the land. But the harbour was inaccessible. An impenetrable chain was now defended by 8 large ships, more than 20 of a smaller size, with several galleys and sloops. And instead of forcing this barrier, the Turks might apprehend a naval sally and a second encounter in the open sea. In this perplexity, the genius of Muhammad conceived and executed a plan of a bold and marvelous cast, of transporting by land his lighter vessels and military stores from the Bosphorus into the higher part of the harbour. The distance is about 10 miles. The ground is uneven, and was overspread with thickets, and as the road must be opened behind the suburb of Galata, their free passage or total destruction must depend on the option of the Genoese. But these selfish merchants were ambitious of the favour of being the last devoured, and the deficiency of art was supplied by the strength of obedient myriads. A level way was covered with a broad platform of strong and solid planks, and to render them more slippery and smooth, they were anointed with the fat of sheep and oxen. 40 light galleys and brigantines of 50 and 30 oars were disembarked on the Bosphorus shore, arranged successively on rollers, and drawn forwards by the power of men and pulleys. 2 guides or pilots were stationed at the helm and the prow of each vessel. The sails were unfurled to the winds, and the labour was cheered by song and acclamation. In the course of a single night, this Turkish fleet painfully climbed the hill, steered over the plain, and was launched from the declivity of the shallow waters of the harbour, far above the molestation of the deeper vessels of the Greeks. The real importance of this operation was magnified by the consternation and confidence which it inspired. But the notorious, unquestionable fact was displayed before the eyes and is recorded by the pens of the 2 nations. A similar stratagem had been repeatedly practiced by the ancients. The Ottoman galleys, I must again repeat, should be considered as large boats. And if we compare the magnitude and the distance, the obstacles and the means, the boasted miracle has perhaps been equalled by the industry of our own times. As soon as Muhammad had occupied the upper harbour with a fleet and army, he constructed in the narrowest part a bridge, or rather mole, of 50 cubits in breadth and 100 in length. It was formed of casks and hogsheads, joined with rafters, linked with iron, and covered with a solid floor. On this floating battery he planted one of his largest cannon, while the 40 galleys, with troops and scaling ladders, approached the most accessible side, which had formerly been stormed by the Latin conquerors. The indolence of the Christians has been accused for not destroying these unfinished works, but their fire, by a superior fire, was controlled and silenced. Nor were they wanting in a nocturnal attempt to burn the vessels, as well as the bridge of the Sultan. His vigilance prevented their approach. Their foremost galleots were sunk or taken. 40 youths, the bravest of Italy and Greece, were inhumanly massacred at his command. Nor could the emperor's grief be assuaged by the just, though cruel, retaliation of exposing from the walls the heads of 260 Muslim captives. After a siege of 40 days, the fate of Constantinople could no longer be averted. The diminutive garrison was exhausted by a double attack. The fortifications, which had stood for ages against hostile violence, were dismantled on all sides by the Ottoman cannon. Many breaches were opened, and near the gate of St. Romanus, four towers had been levelled with the ground. For the payment of his feeble and mutinous troops, Constantine was compelled to despoil the churches with the promise of a fourfold restitution, and his sacrilege offered a new reproach to the enemies of the Union. A spirit of discord impaired the remnant of the Christian strength. The Genoese and Venetian auxiliaries asserted the preeminence of their respective service, and Giustiniani and the great duke, whose ambition was not extinguished by the common danger, accused each other of treachery and cowardice. During the siege of Constantinople, the words of peace and capitulation had been sometimes pronounced, and several embassies had passed between the camp and the city. The Greek emperor was humbled by adversity, and would have yielded to any terms compatible with religion and royalty. The Turkish sultan was desirous of sparing the blood of his soldiers, still more desirous of securing for his own use the Byzantine treasures. And he accomplished a sacred duty in presenting to the Gabours the choice of circumcision, of tribute, or of death. The avarice of Mohammed might have been satisfied with an annual sum of 100,000 ducats, but his ambition grasped the capital of the East. To the prince he offered a rich equivalent, to the people a free toleration or a safe departure. But after some fruitless treaty, he declared his resolution of finding either a throne or a grave under the walls of Constantinople. A sense of honor and the fear of universal reproach forbade Palaeologus to resign the city into the hands of the Ottomans, and he determined to abide the last extremities of war. Several days were employed by the sultan in the preparations of the assault, and a respite was granted by his favorite science of astrology, which had fixed on the 29th of May as the fortunate and fatal hour. On the evening of the 27th, he issued his final orders, assembled in his presence the military chiefs, and dispersed his heralds through the camp to proclaim the duty and the motives of the perilous enterprise. Fear is the first principle of a despotic government, and his menaces were expressed in the Oriental style that the fugitives and deserters, had they the wings of a bird, should not escape from his inexorable justice. The greatest part of his bashaws and janissaries were the offspring of Christian parents, but the glories of the Turkish name were perpetuated by successive adoption, and in the gradual change of individuals, the spirit of a legion, a regiment, or an order is kept alive by imitation and discipline. In this holy warfare, the Muslims were exhorted to purify their minds with prayer, their bodies with seven ablutions, and to abstain from food till the close of the ensuing day. A crowd of dervishes visited the tents to instill the desire of martyrdom, and the assurance of spending an immortal youth amidst the rivers and gardens of paradise, and in the embraces of the black-eyed virgins. Yet Mohammed principally trusted to the efficacy of temporal and visible rewards. A double pay was promised to the victorious troops. "The city and the buildings," said Mohammed, "are mine. But I resign to your valor the captives and the spoils, the treasures of gold and beauty. Be rich and be happy. Many are the provinces of my empire. The intrepid soldier who first ascends the walls of Constantinople shall be rewarded with the government of the fairest and most wealthy, and my gratitude shall accumulate his honors and fortunes above the measure of his own hopes." Such various and potent motives diffused among the Turks a general ardor, regardless of life and impatient for action. The camp re-echoed with the Muslim shouts of God is God, there is but one God, and Muhammad is the apostle of God. Then the sea and land from Galata to the Seven Towers were illuminated by the blaze of their nocturnal fires. Far different was the state of the Christians, who, with loud and impotent complaints, deplored the guilt or the punishment of their sins. The celestial image of the Virgin had been exposed in solemn procession, but their divine patroness was deaf to their entreaties. They accused the obstinacy of the emperor for refusing a timely surrender, anticipated the horrors of their fate, and sighed for the repose and security of Turkish servitude. The noblest of the Greeks and the bravest of the allies were summoned to the palace to prepare them on the evening of the 28th for the duties and dangers of the general assault. The last speech of Palaeologus was the funeral oration of the Roman Empire. He promised, he conjured, and he vainly attempted to infuse the hope which was extinguished in his own mind. In this world all was comfortless and gloomy, and neither the gospel nor the church have proposed any conspicuous recompense to the heroes who fall in the service of their country. But the example of their prince and the confinement of a siege had armed these warriors with the courage of despair, and the pathetic scene is described by the feelings of the historian Pranza, who was himself present at this mournful assembly. They wept, they embraced. Regardless of their families and fortunes, they devoted their lives, and each commander, departing to his station, maintained all night a vigilant and anxious watch on the rampart. The emperor and some faithful companions entered the dome of Santa Sophia, which in a few hours was to be converted into a mosque, and devoutly received, with tears and prayers, the sacrament of the Holy Communion. He reposed some moments in the palace, which resounded with cries and lamentations, solicited the pardon of all whom he might have injured, then mounted on horseback to visit the gardens and explore the motions of the enemy. The distress and fall of the last Constantine are more glorious than the long prosperity of the Byzantine Caesars. In the confusion of darkness, an assailant may sometimes succeed. Out in this great and general attack, the military judgment and astrological knowledge of Muhammad advised him to expect the morning, the memorable 29th of May, in the 1453rd year of the Christian era. The preceding night had been strenuously employed. The troops, the cannons, and the fascines were advanced to the edge of the ditch, which in many parts presented a smooth and level passage to the breach. And his fourscore galleys, almost touched with the prows and their scaling ladders, the less defensible walls of the harbour. Under pain of death, silence was enjoined. But the physical laws of motion and sound are not obedient to discipline or fear. Each individual might suppress his voice and measure his footsteps, but the march and labor of thousands must inevitably produce a strange confusion of dissonant clamors which reached the ears of the watchmen of the towers. At daybreak, without the customary signal of the morning gun, the Turks assaulted the city by sea and land, and the similitude of a twined or twisted thread has been applied to the closeness and continuity of their line of attack. The foremost ranks consisted of the refuse of the host, a voluntary crowd who fought without order or command, of the feebleness of age or childhood, of peasants and vagrants, and of all who had joined the camp in the blind hope of plunder and martyrdom. The common impulse drove them onwards to the wall. The most audacious to climb were instantly precipitated, and not a dart, not a bullet of the Christians was idly wasted on the accumulated throng. But their strength and ammunition were exhausted in this laborious defense. The ditch was filled with the bodies of the slain. They supported the footsteps of their companions, and of this devoted vanguard, the death was more serviceable than the life. Under their respective bashaws and sanjaks, the troops of Anatolia and Romania were successively led to the charge. Their progress was various and doubtful, but after a conflict of 2 hours, the Greeks still maintained and improved their advantage, and the voice of the emperor was heard, encouraging his soldiers to achieve, by last effort, the deliverance of their country. In that fatal moment, the Janissaries arose, fresh, vigorous, and invincible. The sultan himself, on horseback, with an iron mace in his hand, was the spectator and judge of their valor. He was surrounded by 10,000 of his domestic troops, whom he reserved for the decisive occasion. And the tide of battle was directed and impelled by his voice and eye. His numerous ministers of justice were posted behind the line, to urge, to restrain, and to punish. And if danger was in the front, shame and inevitable death were in the rear of the fugitives. The cries of fear and of pain were drowned in the martial music of drums, trumpets, and atabals. And experience has proved that the mechanical operation of sounds, by quickening the circulation of the blood and spirits, will act on the human machine more forcibly than the eloquence of reason and honor. From the lines, the galleys, and the bridge, the Ottoman artillery thundered on all sides. And the camp and city, the Greeks and the Turks, were involved in a cloud of smoke which could only be dispelled by the final deliverance or destruction of the Roman Empire. The single combats of the heroes of history or fable amuse our fancy and engage our affections. The skillful evolutions of war may inform the mind and improve a necessary, though pernicious, science. But in the uniform and odious pictures of a general assault, all is blood and horror and confusion, nor shall I strive at the distance of 300 and 1,000 miles to delineate a scene of which there could be no spectators, and of which the actors themselves were incapable of forming any just or adequate idea. The immediate loss of Constantinople may be ascribed to the bullet or arrow which pierced the gauntlet of John Giustiniani. The sight of his blood and the exquisite pain appalled the courage of the chief, whose arms and counsels were the firmest rampart of the city. As he withdrew from his station in quest of a surgeon, his flight was perceived and stopped by the indefatigable emperor. "Your wound," exclaimed Palaeologus, "is slight. The danger is pressing. Your presence is necessary. And whither will you retire?" "I will retire," said the trembling Genoese, "by the same road which God has opened to the Turks." And at these words he hastily passed through one of the breaches of the inner wall. By this pusillanimous act he stained the honors of a military life, and the few days which he survived in Galata, or the Isle of Chios, were embittered by his own and the public reproach. His example was imitated by the greatest part of the Latin auxiliaries, and the defense began to slacken when the attack was pressed with redoubled vigor. The number of the Ottomans was 50, perhaps 100 times superior to that of the Christians. The double walls were reduced by the cannon to a heap of ruins. In a circuit of several miles, some places must be found more easy of access or more feebly guarded. And if the besiegers could penetrate in a single point, the whole city was irrecoverably lost. The first who deserved the sultan's reward was Hassan the Janissary, of gigantic stature and strength. With his scimitar in one hand and his buckler in the other, he ascended the outward fortification. Of the 30 Janissaries who were emulous of his valor, 18 perished in the bold adventure. Hassan and his 12 companions had reached the summit. The giant was precipitated from the rampart. he rose on one knee, and was again oppressed by a shower of darts and stones. But his success had proved that the achievement was possible. The walls and towers were instantly covered with a swarm of Turks, and the Greeks, now driven from the vantage ground, were overwhelmed by increasing multitudes. Amidst these multitudes, the emperor, who accomplished all the duties of a general and a soldier, was long seen and finally lost. The nobles who fought round his person sustained, till their last breath, the honourable names of Palaeologus and Cantacuzini. His mournful exclamation was heard, "Cannot there be found a Christian to cut off my head?" And his last fear was that of falling alive into the hands of the infidels. The prudent despair of Constantine cast away the purple. Amidst the tumult he fell by an unknown hand, and his body was buried under a mountain of the slain. After his death, resistance and order were no more. The Greeks fled towards the city, and many were pressed and stifled in the narrow pass of the gate of St. Romanus. The victorious Turks rushed through the breaches of the inner wall, and as they advanced into the streets, they were soon joined by their brethren who had forced the gate Thinar on the side of the harbour. In the first heat of the pursuit, about 2,000 Christians were put to the sword. But avarice soon prevailed over cruelty, and the victors acknowledged that they should immediately have given quarter if the valour of the emperor and his chosen bands had not prepared them for a similar opposition in every part of the capital. It was thus, after a siege of 53 days, that Constantinople, which had defied the power of Chosroes, the Chagan, and the Caliphs, was irretrievably subdued by the arms of Mohammed II. Her empire only had been subverted by the Latins. Her religion was trampled in the dust by the Muslim conquerors. The tidings of misfortune fly with a rapid wing, yet such was the extent of Constantinople that the more distant quarters might prolong, some moments, the happy ignorance of their ruin. But in the general consternation, in the feelings of selfish or social anxiety, in the tumult and thunder of the assault, a sleepless night and morning must have elapsed. Nor can I believe that many Grecian ladies were awakened by the Janissaries from a sound and tranquil slumber. On the assurance of the public calamity, the houses and convents were instantly deserted, and the trembling inhabitants flocked together in the streets, like a herd of timid animals, as if accumulated weakness could be productive of strength, or in the vain hope that amid the crowd each individual might be safe and invisible. From every part of the capital they flowed into the church of Santa Sophia. In the space of an hour, the sanctuary, the choir, the nave, the upper and lower galleries were filled with the multitudes of fathers and husbands, of women and children, of priests, monks, and religious virgins. The doors were barred on the inside, and they sought protection from the sacred dome, which they had so lately abhorred as a profane and polluted edifice. Their confidence was founded on the prophecy of an enthusiast or impostor, that one day the Turks would enter Constantinople and pursue the Romans as far as the Column of Constantine in the square before Santa Sophia, but that this would be the term of their calamities, that an angel would descend from heaven with a sword in his hand, and would deliver the empire with that celestial weapon to a poor man seated at the foot of the column. "Take this sword," would he say, "and avenge the people of the Lord." At these animating words, the Turks would instantly fly, and the victorious Romans would drive them from the west and from all Anatolia as far as the frontiers of Persia. It is on this occasion that Ducas, with some fancy and much truth, upbraids the discord and obstinacy of the Greeks. "Had that angel appeared," exclaims the historian, Had he offered to exterminate your foes if you would consent to the union of the church? Even then, in that fatal moment, you would have rejected your safety or have deceived your God. While they expected the descent of the tardy angel, the doors were broken with axes, and as the Turks encountered no resistance, their bloodless hands were employed in selecting and securing the multitude of their prisoners. Youth, beauty, and the appearance of wealth attracted their choice, and the right of property was decided among themselves by prior seizure, by personal strength, and by the authority of command. In the space of an hour, the male captives were bound with cords, the females with their veils and girdles. The senators were linked with their slaves, the prelates with the porters of the church, and young men of a plebeian class with noble maids whose faces had been invisible to the sun and their nearest kindred. In this common captivity, the ranks of society were confounded. The ties of nature were cut asunder, and the inexorable soldier was careless of the father's groans, the tears of the mother, and the lamentations of the children. The loudest in their wailings were the nuns, who were torn from the altar with naked bosoms, outstretched hands, and disheveled hair. And we should piously believe that few could be tempted to prefer the vigils of the harem to those of the monastery. Of these unfortunate Greeks, of these domestic animals, whole strings were rudely driven through the streets, and as the conquerors were eager to return for more prey, their trembling pace was quickened with menaces and blows. At the same hour a similar rapine was exercised in all the churches and monasteries, in all the palaces and habitations of the capital. Nor could any place, however sacred or sequestered, protect the persons or the property of the Greeks. Above 60,000 of this devoted people were transported from the city to the camp and fleet, exchanged or sold according to the caprice or interest of their masters, and dispersed in remote servitude through the provinces of the Ottoman Empire. Among these we may notice some remarkable characters. The historian Franza, first chamberlain and principal secretary, was involved with his family in the common lot. After suffering 4 months the hardships of slavery, he recovered his freedom. In the ensuing winter he ventured to Adrianople and ransomed his wife from the Mir Bashi, or master of the horse. But his two children, in the flower of youth and beauty, had been seized for the use of Mohammed himself. The daughter of Franza died in the seraglio, perhaps a virgin. His son, in the 15th year of his age, preferred death to infamy, and was stabbed by the hand of the royal lover. A deed thus inhuman cannot surely be expiated by the taste and liberality with which he released a Grecian matron and her two daughters on receiving a Latin ode from Philelphus, who had chosen a wife in that noble family. The pride or cruelty of Mohammed would have been most sensibly gratified by the capture of a Roman legate, but the dexterity of Cardinal Isidore eluded the search, and he escaped from Galata in a plebeian habit. The chain and entrance of the outward harbour was still occupied by the Italian ships of merchandise and war. They had signalized their valour in the siege. They embraced the moment of retreat, while the Turkish mariners were dissipated in the pillage of the city. When they hoisted sail, the beach was covered with a suppliant and lamentable crowd. But the means of transportation were scanty. The Venetians and Genoese selected their countrymen, and notwithstanding the fairest promises of the Sultan, the inhabitants of Galata evacuated their houses and embarked with their most precious effects. In the fall and the sack of great cities, an historian is condemned to repeat the tale of uniform calamity. The same effects must be produced by the same passions. And when those passions may be indulged without control, small, alas, is the difference between civilized and savage man. Amidst the vague exclamations of bigotry and hatred, the Turks are not accused of a wanton or immoderate effusion of Christian blood, but according to their maxims, the maxims of antiquity, the lives of the vanquished were forfeited, and the legitimate reward of the conqueror was derived from the service, the sale, or the ransom of his captives of both sexes. The wealth of Constantinople had been granted by the Sultan to his victorious troops, and the rapine of an hour is more productive than the industry of years. But as no regular division was attempted of the spoil, the respective shares were not determined by merit, and the rewards of valor were stolen away by the followers of the camp, who had declined the toil and danger of the battle. The narrative of their depredations could not afford either amusement or instruction. The total amount in the last poverty of the empire has been valued at 4 millions of ducats, and of this sum a small part was the property of the Venetians, the Genoese, the Florentines, and the merchants of Ancona. Of these foreigners the stock was improved in quick and perpetual circulation, but the riches of the Greeks were displayed in the idle ostentation of palaces and wardrobes, or deeply buried in treasures of ingots and old coin, lest it should be demanded at their hands for the defense of their country. The profanation and plunder of the monasteries and churches excited the most tragic complaints. The dome of Santa Sophia itself, the earthly heaven, the second firmament, the vehicle of the cherubim, the throne of the glory of God, was despoiled of the oblations of ages. And the gold and silver, the pearls and jewels, the vases and sacerdotal ornaments, were most wickedly converted to the service of mankind. After the divine images had been stripped of all that could be valuable to a profane eye, the canvas or the wood was torn or broken or burnt or trod under foot or applied in the stables or the kitchen to the vilest uses. The example of sacrilege was imitated, however, from the Latin conquerors of Constantinople, and the treatment which Christ, the Virgin, and the saints had sustained from the guilty Catholic might be inflicted by the zealous Muslim on the monuments of idolatry. Perhaps, instead of joining the public clamor, a philosopher will observe that in the decline of the arts, the workmanship could not be more valuable than the work, and that a fresh supply of visions and miracles would speedily be renewed by the craft of the priest and the credulity of the people. He will more seriously deplore the loss of the Byzantine libraries, which were destroyed or scattered in the general confusion. 120,000 manuscripts are said to have disappeared. 10 volumes might be purchased for a single ducat, and the same ignominious price, too high perhaps for a shelf of theology, included the whole works of Aristotle and Homer, the noblest productions of the science and literature of ancient Greece. We may reflect with pleasure that an inestimable portion of our classic treasures was safely deposited in Italy, and that the mechanics of a German town had invented an art which derides the havoc of time and barbarism. From the first hour of the memorable 29th of May, disorder and rapine prevailed in Constantinople till the 8th hour of the same day, when the Sultan himself passed in triumph through the gate of St. Romanus. He was attended by his viziers, bashaws, and guards, each of whom, says a Byzantine historian, was robust as Hercules, dexterous as Apollo, and equal in battle to any 10 of the race of ordinary mortals. The conqueror gazed with satisfaction and wonder on the strange, though splendid appearance of the domes and palaces, so dissimilar from the style of Oriental architecture. In the hippodrome, or Atmeidan, his eye was attracted by the twisted column of the 3 serpents, and as a trial of his strength, he shattered with his iron mace or battle-axe the under jaw of one of these monsters, which in the eyes of the Turks were the idols or talismans of the city. At the principal door of Santa Sophia, he alighted from his horse and entered the dome. And such was his jealous regard for that monument of his glory, that on observing a zealous Muslim in the act of breaking the marble pavement, he admonished him with his scimitar, that if the spoil and captives were granted to the soldiers, the public and private buildings had been reserved for the prince. By his command, the metropolis of the Eastern Church was transformed into a mosque. The rich and portable instruments of superstition had been removed. The crosses were thrown down, and the walls, which were covered with images and mosaics, were washed and purified, and restored to a state of naked simplicity. On the same day, or on the ensuing Friday, the muezzin, or crier, ascended the most lofty turret, and proclaimed the ezan, or public invitation in the name of God and his prophet. The imam preached, and Muhammad II performed the namaz of prayer and thanksgiving on the great altar where the Christian mysteries had so lately been celebrated before the last of the Caesars. From Santa Sophia he proceeded to the august but desolate mansion of 100 successors of the great Constantine, but which in a few hours had been stripped of the pomp of royalty. A melancholy reflection on the vicissitudes of human greatness forced itself on his mind, and he repeated an elegant distich of Persian poetry. The spider has wove his web in the imperial palace, and the owl hath sung her watch-song on the towers of Afrasiab. Yet his mind was not satisfied, nor did the victory seem complete till he was informed of the fate of Constantine, whether he had escaped or been made prisoner, or had fallen in the battle. 2 Janissaries claimed the honor and reward of his death. The body, under a heap of slain, was discovered by the golden eagles embroidered on his shoes. The Greeks acknowledged with tears the head of their late emperor, and, after exposing the bloody trophy, Mohammed bestowed on his rival the honors of a decent funeral. After his decease, Lucas Notoras, great duke and first minister of the empire, was the most important prisoner. When he offered his person and his treasures at the foot of the throne, "And why," said the indignant sultan, "did you not employ these treasures in the defense of your prince and country?" "They were yours," answered the slave. "God had reserved them for your hands." "If he reserved them for me," replied the despot, "how have you presumed to withhold them so long by fruitless and fatal resistance?" The great duke alleged the obstinacy of the strangers, and some secret encouragement from the Turkish vizier. And from this perilous interview he was at length dismissed with the assurance of pardon and protection. Mohammed condescended to visit his wife, a venerable princess oppressed with sickness and grief, and his consolation for her misfortunes was in the most tender strain of humanity and filial reverence. A similar clemency was extended to the principal officers of state, of whom several were ransomed at his expense. And during some days he declared himself the friend and father of the vanquished people. But the scene was soon changed, and before his departure the hippodrome streamed with the blood of his noblest captives. His perfidious cruelty is execrated by the Christians. They adorn with the colors of heroic martyrdom the execution.